Welcome to the Sunday Morning Linux Review with Tony Bemis and Matt Enders. This is episode 12 for the week of January 1st, 2012. Happy New Year.
So with us this week, we have Mary Tomich. Sorry, Mary, can we use your last name?
Well, sure.
All right, we use our last names.
All right. That's
fine. But some people are a little security paranoid. Stallman, who shall remain nameless. But anyway, we're not wrapping our Wallace in tinfoil or anything here. So.
Or a Faraday cage.
Broadcasting from a Faraday cage. So no, Mary's here. She's got this nifty Zarezan laptop I'm drooling over. Though she says that she's not been able to use the 64-bit flash. She's had to drop back to 32-bit.
That's right. When I ordered it from Zarezan, it came, of course, with 64-bit Linux installed, and I persevered for several months, and then finally I just decided to reinstall 32-bit because I just needed the full functionality of my browser, and now I've got it, so I'm pretty happy with it. Rock solid laptop, though.
Yeah, that's the biggest complaint I'm hearing about the 64-bit, and I haven't tried it on anything yet. I've even got a couple of servers that I'm still running 32-bit Linux on, just because I know that 32-bit is rock solid and works perfectly, and we got a few more years we can give 64 to mature. You know? Yeah. But then 2032 is not right around the corner.
Well, then give it just a couple of years, and Flash will be no more, and HTML5 will take it all over, and then it won't even matter.
Then it won't matter. That's true. But when I went to Adobe's website to download it, they had this little notice for 64-bit Linux users, and you had to go to this other little page, and you had to do, there were just a few more hoops than I was willing to go through at that particular time. But as I said, it's working great now, and I really like it.
Excellent.
So. Cool. So, New Year's Day. My wife was trying to figure out any kind of reason to get me not to come. I'm like, but I have all the equipment. She's like, just cancel it. I'm like, you're not the one getting up in the morning.
Oh, last night this was happening? Cause, yeah. Because I'm like, my wife's not even up when I leave the house for this. So, yeah. But, I don't know. She didn't give me any crap about it either. I think she's like, wants to get rid of me a lot of the times.
So. Well. So how far do you have to go, Tony, to get here?
I only live about 20 minutes away, so it's not a long drive.
Okay.
It's closer than you.
I start off in Detroit.
Yeah, and I've got that massive 10 minutes.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so here we are.
Yes, we are.
And,
Matt, what's happening with the kernel?
So what have you got this week for us, Matt?
All right, in the kernel... I didn't have a chance to actually put together any notes on it, so I'm just going to read Linus's announcement, all right? For the latest RC releases, 3.2-RC7, and here's what Linus has to say. There it is, likely the last -RC before the final 3.2, so please do check it out and in between your holiday festivities. Most of the changes are fairly simple one-liners, but some QLA4XXX driver updates stand out and in fact account for about 40% of the diff. That together with a VMware DRI driver update and some DVB updates and the regular random driver fixes means that 80%+ of the changes are in drivers. Some net updates, some SH updates, and then a tiny smattering of other stuff. The append short log gives the fairly boring details. And that's what Linus has to say about the release. And there were no stable kernel updates this week. And I also have no kernel quote this week. Oh, but this isn't really kernel news. But I have to, now that I'm done with the kernel news, I have to apologize to the Mint guys. I was going to do this at the beginning of the show and forgot. But I went on a big rant against Mint 12 last week. I take it all back. I've been running Mint 12 with Mate. And I did the one file redirection. Somehow, I must have had an old config file laying around, and it was pointing the shortcut in the start menu to Pac-Man, which was no longer installed instead of Nautilus. That's why Nautilus wasn't starting. So once I changed that direction, it's working perfectly and beautifully. I've been using Mint 12 with Mate for a week now, and my productivity is back up on par.
So, all right.
My apologies to the Mint guys for that rant last week.
You know, Matt, I have been thinking about using Mint, but as far as audio and video files, how does Mint handle those?
Oh, out of the box, they all work. You don't have to go find any codecs, anything. It's a beautiful experience. That's one of the reasons I switched to Mint. I was running straight up Debian, and then I switched to Mint because I was running, because you can do it with Debian too, but then you got to install the Debian multimedia repositories, and it's still always a kind of a hacky thing. But Mint right out of the box, boom. So.
All right. Well, I think maybe that'll be a New Year's project for me this week, is I'll install in a virtual machine and just check it out.
And they do have another environment. They also use Genome 3 with what they call the MGSE. Which are the Mint Genome something extensions. I forget what the S stands for. but what it does is it makes Genome 3 work almost like it was Genome 2.
Shell.
Yeah, that's what the S stands for, shell. Good shell. Job, Tony.
good
pickup.
2 minutes later.
but it's the Mint Genome Shell extensions. Mm-hmm. And because it gives you your bar back down here at the bottom in Genome 3, which they did away with. But the thing I don't like about it that really annoys me is you got to go to three places to do stuff. You got a start menu down here in the lower left. You got a menu up here that drops more stuff down from the upper left. And then you got to go to turn it on and off over here to the right.
The upper right.
The upper right, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was a little annoying.
I just wanted to make sure I plugged those in as you were gesturing.
Oh, yes. Because, yes, the listeners cannot see me pointing at the laptop.
He was pointing at various corners of his screen. So just to clarify that.
Yeah. It was lower left, upper left, and upper right. So.
That's right.
So, yes, that kind of annoys me. But Mate is actually perfect. It's mature enough that I've used it productively all week. Had no problems at all. So
sweet.
So yep, that's all I have for the kernel, and my apology to the Mint people, which kind of slid in with the kernel stuff. So
Tony, what's going on with the Linux distributions this week?
We've got a ton of releases this week, more than last week, and there's actually a release this morning.
No way.
Yeah, right? They
it has to be overseas.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's kind of like the first baby born out of the
Yeah, there you go.
And I can't even say it. A-T-P-O-S-I-D. Aptid. Aptid. This is all on DistroWatch.
And it was this morning?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's two actually releases today.
Yeah, and SUSE released also. The EduLife. The Aptid. Okay.
All right, we'll go with that, Mary. That's as good as anything else we can come up with.
They say they're referencing the Coordinated Universal Time, or UTC.
They're the first distro that was released after UTC switched to the new year. That's what that says.
Yeah. So go for them. I'm trying to look here. I don't see anything really that stands out, opposed to other ones.
But no, I just think that they wanted to be the first ones of the new year.
Yeah. And then Seduction was released yesterday. They're a desktop-oriented distribution and live CD based on Debian's Unstable Branch. Yep.
Sid.
Hence Seduction.
Yes, hence Seduction. Oh, my. Ooh. Amazing how that works.
We have Linux Deepin, which is a Chinese-based. Yes, I know. And then there's, EXT?
Yeah, you skipped it because you didn't want to try and say
X-tix.
It.
X-tix.
X-tix is a Ubuntu-based desktop for 64-bit computers.
I guess I won't be installing it.
That flash. Oh, man.
New flash.
Netrunner is another one. And that's Kubuntu-based distro. It's featuring carefully tuned KDE desktop and integrated KDE and GNOME applications. So I guess it has all the GNOME libraries to make sure everything works right.
So let's just throw all that bloatware in there. That's what these guys are saying.
Right.
Let's just blow that distro right up to 2 gigs.
I think it's not as much of an issue these days as it might have been maybe 5 or 10 years ago, because I subscribe to the school of thought, get the best tool for the job. And so even though my desktop is KDE, I have on occasion put a few GNOME tools in there.
Yeah, and I do the same thing because I really like the KB3 burning utility. Mm-hmm. So even though I install the KB3 burning utility, which drags in, you know, half a KDE with it.
Right.
So yeah, I'm kind of being a little hypocritical there, but I don't care.
Sure. I've done that a couple times too. When I was looking for some good email clients a couple years ago, I was doing KMail and a couple other ones, but
why?
I ended up going back to Evolution. Because I wanted something. Evolution was running slow.
Oh, and it is a hog.
Right. But I wanted something that could do both calendaring and mail and multiple mail accounts. So that I was going through a bunch of things and nothing really stacks up to running both of them in the same client.
You know, and you know what personally I've gone to is I just use the web interface for Gmail because Gmail is my main. I have a couple other, but mostly my Gmail account's what I use for everything. And I just use the web interface. I've gone totally, I don't even install an email client anymore.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I have like 5 different emails I check, then, and they're not all with the same
service. With Gmail, you can have them all come to Gmail.
I know. And actually, I do that for my wife, but I don't want to like have it all coming into the same email account. Because there's like some organization I do between the accounts.
Yes, and well, that's you know what
the sender address. If you were to reply, then it gets you reply out through the Gmail account rather.
But you can tell Gmail to send as that other account.
Yeah, and that's how I have Kim set up.
Does it do any checking to make sure that it's legit?
Well, because you're receiving mail on that account too.
Okay.
But
any client you can tell it to reply to as a different email address, and it never checks.
It just
so you can always spoof that.
Oh, because my internet service provider, I know I have to go in and set things up in order for other email addresses that I have it'll be sent out through them. Otherwise, it just says.
Is that AT&T?
Oh, that might be because
I had to do that before too.
Well, and a lot of ISPs block port 25. Mm-hmm. So that could be a problem there, too.
That's only if you're running your own web mail server.
You know what? I wasn't running a mail server, and I had a problem with it on my AT&T DSL. This was going back probably 6 or 7 years, with using Gmail. I had to switch from port 25 to something else. Or was it? It might not have been Gmail. It might have been some other web-based mail, but I think it was Gmail.
Hmm. Well, and I know when I set up Thunderbird, I tried to set up the SMT.
Because I was using Evolution, and actually, at the time, I was using Evolution, so I wasn't using the web interface, so it was actually using the ports to get and send the mail, even though I was using Gmail. So
just switch over to the secure ports.
That's what I did.
Yeah.
443, I think, is what it is. No, that's the web. I don't know what the email one is.
Yeah, it's like 953 or
something like that.
Right. I always have to look it up every time.
It's just one of those things.
Right. Were you about to say something, Mary?
I was only going to mention that when I set up Thunderbird, you know, this is going back along the email lines, AT&T, for some reason, I wanted to set up my SMTP server for 1&1, which is the hosting service or the service where I've got my domains and my email and all that. And despite the fact that I had all the information set up in Thunderbird, I cannot use that. And AT&T kept telling me, "Well, you should be able to use it, but for some reason it never would go."
They're blocking port 25, and they tell you they're blocking port 25. So I don't know why they would say they're not.
I was using a different port. I don't think it was four. Might have to go look it up. But
443 is the secure for website. I don't. Know. I don't remember what it is for.
Well, you know what I had to do is when I was using the AT&T's SMTP servers. And I wanted to send it out as a different account, then you had to go onto their website and register every single account that you're going to send it out as. Mm-hmm. And so that was because I have my 5, and then my wife has one, and then, you know, so it was a lot of work. And I was trying to run my own mail server at that point, I'm like, well, this is just a waste. You know, and I was on a residential, you know, line, so it's not like, you know, they didn't want me doing it anyways. But yeah, it's a lot of work. Anyway, our next one is Endian Firewall 2.5. That's a Red Hat based distro for firewalls. So it looks like there's a firewall based on just about every major out there. There's the Ubuntu one, there's the Debian one, which I think was last week.
Yep. And pfSense, which is based on FreeBSD.
Yep. And then this one. There's the OpenSUSE one, too. I can't think of the name right now, but...
I don't care. Anything besides pfSense sucks anyway.
Tell us how you really feel.
I generally don't hold back, Mary.
Yeah. And then we have Calculate Linux 11.12. It's a Gentoo-based distro with focus on desktop and server computing.
Gentoo-based. Who would ever use anything Gentoo as a server? You'd spend every... You'd be using so many cycles to compile your updates. It's just crazy.
Yeah, well, that's why I thought the whole thing with having Gentoo is to compile everything.
Right, that's...
So
that's...
why is there a distro based on that? I don't understand. Because you're compiling and doing everything custom anyways.
Right. So, I don't know.
Anyway, TinyCore has another update this week.
Have you ever used that?
I have not.
I installed it one time. For a client, I needed to get a thin client going for them because they switched to a server thin client kind of setup. And I was looking at using TinyCore and like Ramina to do the... And when you install TinyCore, you get BusyBox, and that's it. There's nothing else there. And it is really small and really fast.
Yeah.
But that's it.
Yeah.
The ISO is 11.9 megabytes?
Yeah. It's small.
Well, that's even up from what they used to be to fit on a floppy. It used to be 3 meg. Mm-hmm. And they've updated that, so now they're getting bloated. and then we have SMS server, which is the Superb Mini Server 1.6.3, which is Slackware based for servers. I heard that's pretty good for like small business, but I haven't heard much.
Well, you know what I've really been... There's that one that's based on Ubuntu called Fidor or Fyadora or something like that. It looks like it's got a really nice interface to set everything up as a file server, whatever. It's looking pretty nice. I still do all my stuff by hand. Like, for a file server, I'll install straight up Debian, then install Samba, and then I'll install, and I do it that way. But if
the prepackaged server distros, you...
I don't really use them.
Yeah. I installed, I want to say, it was a long time ago, but it was like Ebox or something like that. And it was kind of nice because it put in place several different packages or several different server-based packages and things, but I may give that a try.
I was trying to simplify my process because it takes me a little while to do that. I mean, when you do that with Debian, you install the basic Debian, then you start installing all the services you need to either do a web server or do a file server. I mean, you're putting some time in. It takes you probably a good 3.5 to 5 hours to get a file server up and running after installing all the updates and installing all the stuff I need. So, yeah, I was looking for a simpler way to do it. And that's why I was looking at that Fyador, I think is what it was called.
But if you're looking for is a file server, all you need is Samba and maybe NSF, and that's built in anyway. So, really, you'd be doing that updates.
Well, and SSH, because you need to make sure it's got SSH running and things.
Well, if you install a server, well, I guess Debian doesn't have a server.
I just installed Debian, I just installed the total base and then build from there. So that's why it takes the... I'm sure I could pick those packages to install at the time of installation.
Yeah.
But I like doing it.
What I like about Debian is with the apt, you can choose like the group package to install. And so if you want to install LAMP, you know, the Linux, Apache, MySQL, and PHP, you just install that one package or tell that one command, and it installs everything for it that you need. So it's really convenient. I know that Red Hat does that also with yum. But it's a different command. It's not actually yum. It's like yum group or something. Klaatu was talking about that a couple weeks ago.
Klaatu. Do you know, is that his name or is that a handle?
That's a handle.
Is it? Because I hear him on like five different podcasts, and I've never been able to figure out whether that's his actual name or if that's a handle. So.
It's a handle. I don't know anybody that would have.
Well, I don't know. Some of the, I mean, you get over there in the Ukraine and Czechoslovakia, they got some pretty wacky names going on.
No, he's around here. He's actually from the Midwest, I think.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, because he went to...
Oh, you know what he is?
Because
the one Ohio podcast Fest. I listen to him on, the one guy's on the East Coast, and the one guy's on the West Coast, and he's in the Midwest. So yeah. So they have all the regions covered.
On Hacker Public Radio, he did a lot of interviews at Ohio Linux Fest.
Oh, really?
Posted him there, yeah. Anyway, we got Simplice, Linux 2.0.0. Why do you need two dots for zeros in there? But
yeah, we talked about that last week, too.
I think it's implying that they're going to have a lot of builds.
Right.
That's how I would interpret it.
I don't know. That's what Tony said, because something last week was like 2.3.0, and I'm like, .0, what the hell do you need that .0 for? What's that? And Tony's like, well, maybe because they want to show you that it's the actual first one of the .3. I'm like, well, if there's nothing there, you kind of get that, too, you know? But, yeah,
right.
I don't know. I think they're trying to be grandiose.
Yeah. But what's interesting about them, they're doing the OpenBox window manager, and they're unstable also. Debian Sid. Anyway, and then there's GRML.
Grmel. I've used that. Grmel. It's a rescue desk.
Ah. Yeah, that's for scripts for system administrators.
Yeah.
Sweet.
The distro of the week, according to DistroWatch, calculated by website hits per day.
Let's see.
And who's in first place?
You got to update it. You got to.
I know.
Do that, Mary. Oh. Roll up here.
Yeah, you got to change that from.
And you got to change this to last 7 days, and then click refresh.
Well, I was hoping somebody else would just tell me.
Start at number five. Number five is Debian.
It's really.
They have 1172 hits.
Oh, man. Down. Everybody is down. It's the got to be the holidays.
No. You got to change it. Not everybody. Like, I'm on the last 7 days.
Oh, I accidentally updated for the last 30 days. My bad.
CentOS is at 1223, which they're down, too. And then Fedora is up for 1284. Ubuntu is at number two with 1571, and they're up. And Mint is...
Even
at
3909.
Yeah.
Gotta love that minty goodness.
I guess.
They must be having a lot of people link into Mint.
Well, and then, you know, and we talked about it too. Those hits are the DistroWatch page hits, not the actual page hits. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can remember a few years ago when I was on the Memphis bandwagon, and actually I do like Memphis, is I would hit every link.
Are they still around?
Yeah, they are. So I would hit their links. I'd hit all their links thinking, oh, hopefully I'll drive up that that popularity. But obviously that was years ago.
I have, because I haven't seen a Memphis release in a year and a day.
I think they still are. I mean, a few months ago they were.
Yeah, but when's the last time they had a release?
Well, their cycle is probably different than a
Memphis. Yeah, 8 years? Come on, what's the release cycle? It can't be longer than Debian's. Debian's is 2 years. Come on.
Yeah, here.
Last update was Friday 23rd, December 2011.
So there, Matt.
Well, how come we didn't talk about that, Tony?
Yeah, that
Mr.
was
distro
this week.
Release guy.
I don't know.
Because I don't think you went down
maybe,
far enough. Maybe.
Maybe it's updated, but it's not.
Did you scroll? Because you kind of missed a couple there. Because we recorded early last week, so we didn't get anything that was released on the 23rd that you.
No, here.
Because, like, Body had a release on the 23rd?
Body?
Whatever.
Body.
No, we talked about that last week.
When did we record last week? Oh, we recorded on the 23rd,
on the 23rd.
We?
So we got a
so
couple
got
of the
body,
morning ones.
But we didn't get Grmel.
Right. That's why I skipped Body.
All right. My bad. I apologize.
Oh, here we go. Me. Even though their page was updated, their last distribution release was May 5th of 2011. So it's been over 6 months.
For Memphis?
Yeah, I guess I'm just not keeping up with Memphis. What can I say?
Well, you know,
they're not Mint.
No, but they have a soft. I have a soft spot for them.
And I did run Memphis for a little while, and on some older systems, I actually installed Antix or Anti-X, I don't know whether it should be called Anti-X or Antix.
Antix, but I think.
It's based on Mepis, and it's a lightweight for older computers. It works
and
really
it works,
well.
It does work well. So. I think the
As a matter of fact, I just used it. I just used a live, my old, it's like 8.3 or something, because I wanted to see the boot messages, and because I was having a problem with my wireless. Remember? Because I'd switched back to, and my wireless stopped working. It was RF kill. You ever hear of RF kill? Go to the command line, type in RF kill.
No.
It doesn't kill anything. That's the name of the, it'll say for help, do RF kill / question mark. But what it does is it allows you to interact with your wireless radio directly and turn it on and off. And I just went in there and it tells you what parts are turned on. And what, if you just do RF kill, it tells you what's turned on and what's turned off for your radio.
All right, I'll try it.
That could be useful.
So, it might not be installed. I had to actually install it. Oops. You gotta say list. See?
Is it dash list?
And now they're all... I'm not software blocked, and I'm not hardware blocked. Everything's turned on.
Yeah.
Because the first time I did it, because I posted on the message boards, and I got back, the guy replied with just RF kill, which is enough for me. You tell me, I go find out how to use it, and it worked. Because the first time I ran it, two of the things were turned off. So the other thing is like, you do unblock all, and then bam, it turns everything right back on.
Oh, that's good to know. Now, so hardware block, that would be an instance if you had kind of a wireless switch.
Yeah, and I have a hardware button.
Okay.
And pushing the button did nothing. It didn't. Wouldn't turn it back on.
Really?
When I did the unblock all, turned it right back on.
What distro were you using at the time?
I'm going to have to slap you, Tony.
I'm going to get out of the way.
I told you. Didn't I tell you? I said that distro probably doesn't have the drivers.
No, it had the drivers, but somehow the switch got turned off, and it wouldn't turn back on.
Oh.
It was the problem. Because when I first installed...
Did you try reboot? Sorry.
No, he actually installed two different
distros. I actually installed two different distros. I did more than just reboot. It was making me crazy. Because what happened was the first time I had tried Mint 12... Mm-hmm. I was working in Mate, and I'm trying to be productive, or surfing the net, take your pick. And every 3 minutes, it would pop up, because I was working in a wired environment in my house, but I'm close enough to my neighbors that I could see their encrypted connection. Mm-hmm. Okay, so every 3 minutes, it would pop and say, hey, put your password in to connect to this, and I'm like, go away, and then 3 minutes later, go away. And so I went out to the Mint forums, and they said, just turn off your wireless. So I turned off my wireless, and they could not turn it back on.
Oh.
That's what started the whole thing.
So it was Mint.
It was not Mint.
Okay.
Was it like Debian?
I'm going to have to say it was a complete PebCac error on my part.
Okay.
I will take the heat.
All right.
Because, and for those of you who are not... like administrators out there or technicians, PEBCAC stands for Problem Exists Between Chair and Keyboard.
That's right.
Yeah.
The ID10, what is it?
ID10T? Yeah, definitely. PEBCAC/ID10T.
ID10T error.
So that's all I have for the distros this week.
All right.
I think I'm going to install that SMS.
Yeah.
Server that distro and just check it out, because I've got a Dell box sitting upstairs on the third floor of my house, and it's just sitting there doing nothing. And it was my server until I took it offline for issues, but I'll give that a try and see how it is.
And if you can find it, I just tried Googling for it, but I can't remember what it was called. I've got it at home on a disk though, so I can find out what it's called. Mm-hmm. It's based on Ubuntu, and it's called like Fyodor. I can't even freaking think of it.
I'll Google it.
But I'll send you an email.
Okay.
Too soon.
All right.
So.
It's time for the tech news of the week.
We have the vote on SOPA was delayed until mid-January at the earliest. The SOPA, Stop Online Piracy Act, vote scheduled for 12/21/11 was postponed until January. A committee spokesperson said that they will not set a new vote date until they return from break in January. This means that the earliest that a scheduled vote could take place would be mid-January. This is the second postponement of the committee vote on SOPA, which requires ISPs, search engines, and other content providers to alter DNS records and search results, resulting in the censorship of foreign websites supposedly, air quote, dedicated to providing copyright infringing material. The committee has already had two marathon sessions that ended abruptly after opponents expressed staunch opposition. The artists are not the one behind this law. The huge corporations, lawyers, and boards who are pushing this incredibly bad legislation. Here is a list of the companies behind just one of the lobbying groups pushing SOPA. Now, this is a huge list, and it'll all be in the show notes, but I'm only going to read a couple. ABC, the American Broadcasting Corporation. BMI, big surprise there. CBS Corporation. Disney Publishing Worldwide, Inc. Yeah, that's also a big surprise. EMI Music, also another big surprise. ESPN, Major League Baseball, and the NFL, NBC Universal, and Viacom. And like I said, the list is probably five times as big as that. So check it out in the show notes. Now you know who to boycott, but you also have to let them know that you are boycotting them. Several grassroots organizations, along with a few tech companies, are putting forth a strong effort against this legislation. They have had some effect, as arguably the most egregious section has undergone a quick rewrite by Representative Lamar Smith, the Judiciary Committee chair and sponsor of this bill. The changes revealed on Monday, 12/12, make the definition of, air quotes again, rogue websites more narrow. It also clarifies that the takedown provisions only apply to foreign websites. There were also several changes intended to alleviate concerns that this legislation would interfere with the architecture of the internet, because as it stands, this bill would force American companies to break DNS. The Net Coalition, which counts AOL, eBay, Facebook, Foursquare, Google, IAC, LinkedIn, Mozilla, OpenDNS, PayPal, Twitter, Wikipedia, Yahoo, and the Zynga Game Network, and really, amongst all those websites, where else are you really going on the internet? So, as members is proposing a blackout day where all of these websites would go down and just show an anti-SOPA message to visitors when they come to these sites, claims Mark Erickson, who heads the Net Coalition Trade Association. If all of these sites went dark at the same time, it would bring national commerce to a screeching halt. This action would also totally disrupt the lives of the majority of Americans, hopefully alerting them to this serious issue and causing them to act.
Matt, I'm just going to jump in. Did you read Amazon in one of those lists?
As supporting it? Or as a member of the coalition?
Yeah.
Amazon was not a member, listed as a member of the coalition.
Okay, I was just kind of curious where they...
I don't know.
Okay.
I have no idea where Amazon comes down on that.
Although, you know, Zynga, you know, you got to get your Facebook apps.
That's right, I'm telling you. And Facebook itself. Do you realize if Facebook went dark, it would cause panic. It would cause panic in the internet.
It would free up a lot of my time.
Me too, actually. So.
They post or boast that there's 800 million users now.
I believe it. Everybody's on Facebook. There is still time to try and defeat this horrendous legislation, and the people at Daily KOS, that's KOS, have made it incredibly easy. If you click on this link, and it'll be in the show notes, and it's too long to read, it will take you directly to a page they have set up that will walk you through sending your representative an email telling them to vote no on this steaming pile of fecal matter. So,
you know what's funny about people? I got an email from my web host this week, a one-on-one, and they said they're coming out against it also.
Well, because after what happened, let me get to the next story then, because it involves GoDaddy's actually participation in SOPA.
Really?
Yeah. GoDaddy rescinds SOPA support after huge boycott initiative. GoDaddy actually supported SOPA.
Oh.
Yep. I read that.
And now, full disclosure here, I have a domain registered with GoDaddy, but they are just the registrar and not the host. So I'm not moving my one domain that is registered there. So that's just for full disclosure before I go into the article. On 12/22, the fact that GoDaddy was actively supporting SOPA, the really egregious part was that not only did GoDaddy support SOPA, they actually took such an active role as writing parts of it. So a boycott was started on Reddit, which took off like wildfire across the internet. One day later, they announced that they were withdrawing their support for SOPA. It is, however, too late for many high-profile domains. Wikimedia Foundation's Jimmy Wales announced on Twitter that all of Wikimedia domains will be moved off of GoDaddy. Cheeseburger's Ben Hu also pledged to move his 1,000-plus domains off of GoDaddy. Hundreds, maybe even thousands more people across the internet joined them in leaving GoDaddy. Y Combinator founder Paul Graham issued a ban on all employees of any company on the official list of SOPA supporters from attending the YC Demo Day. Here's what he had to say about the ban. Several of those companies on the list send people to Demo Day, and when I saw the list, I thought, we should stop inviting them. So yes, we'll remove anyone from those companies from the Demo Day invite list. He then went on to say this, if these companies are so clueless about technology that they think SOPA is a good idea, how could they be good investors? Warren Adelman, GoDaddy's CEO, had this to say about them rescinding their support for SOPA. Fighting online piracy is of the utmost importance, which is why GoDaddy has been working to help craft revisions to this legislation. But we can clearly do better. He went on to say this also. It's very important that all internet stakeholders work together on this. Getting it right is worth the wait. GoDaddy will support it when and if the internet community supports it. This is a huge win for the free and open internet. It shows that when you can manage to hit a company where it counts in the bottom line, you really can make them change their position. When you read GoDaddy's statement, the weaseliness jumps right out at you, however, which leads me to believe that they are just trying to take the heat off right now and will jump at supporting the next minor revision of SOPA.
So yeah, I think GoDaddy's still in the bag with SOPA, to be honest with you.
Yeah. I think that it was a complete reaction to the huge monetary hit they were taking.
Well, I think when you do transfer your single domain, I've got to believe that's going to be the breaking point.
You do think that will be the breaking point?
I think so. Keep that in mind.
Okay. And my next story is called The Debian Administrator's Handbook. I'm going to try and synopsize the information for you. However, if you go to http://debian-handbook.info, you can read the whole story about the book. The book is currently published in French under the, and I do not speak French and I'm going to butcher this, but I think it is Cahier de la Admin. What do you think, Mary?
I think you butchered it. Okay. I don't speak French either.
All right. Debian. It is the work of two Debian developers, Raphael Hartzog, who maintains dpkg along with several other packages, and Roland Maas, who maintains Argyle and a few other packages. They attempted to have several editors take on the English translation, but none were willing to take the risk. The two then decided to do the translation themselves and then self-publish the work. In order to facilitate the translation, they did a crowdfunding campaign, which raised almost 15,000 euros. They expect the translation to be done around April of 2012. They, however, wanted to take this further and release the book under an open source license acceptable to Debian so that the book can be included in Debian as an installable package, making it a simple apt getaway for anyone running Debian. They have set this goal at 25,000 euros. You can make a donation to the Liberation Fund, that's what they're calling it, here. And again, the link will be in the show notes. If you donate 10 euros or more, you are guaranteed a copy when it is ready. If they meet their goal of 25,000 euros, then everyone will be able to get a free copy. I made my donation already. If I remember correctly, it was about 1374 US dollars. So I will get my copy, but if we can push this over, it will be a great thing. The last time I checked, they were at about 65% of their goal. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mary.
I was just gonna say, and at the rate the euro's going, your donation will even be appear bigger.
I think it's a really cool idea to have it on the app.
Yeah, so just that app get installed away. Yeah. And from what I've read, some stuff about the French book, it's very, very comprehensive. So I'm looking very much forward to getting my copy when the translation's done. So
sweet.
Because I use, on servers, that's my preferred distro. I just like, as we talked about a few minutes ago, install base Debian and then build the server from there. So, and now a little bit about the book. The book requires no prior knowledge of Debian. It will cover all the topics that anyone needs to become an effective Debian administrator, from installation and update to compiling your own kernel and creating Debian packages from sources. along with backup, migration, and advanced topics like SE Linux, automated installation, and virtualization. The first half of the book is for anyone who wants to run Debian. It will teach the basics like installing Debian with the Debian installer, finding documentation, basic troubleshooting, and problem solving. Then the second half of the book is for server administrators. It will discuss things like securing the server, automating installations, using virtualization, and setting up common services like Apache, Postfix, OpenLDAP, Samba, NFS, and many more. You can check out the complete table of contents here. Again, link too long to read, it'll be in the show notes. There is also a free sample chapter available, the Apt Tools chapter. If you would like to check this out to ensure that the book is up to the quality that you would expect, then you can click here. Again, link too long to read, it'll be in the show notes, for a PDF of this great chapter. It covers all of the Apt Tools like apt-get, aptitude, and other associated tools. Now let's answer some questions that you may have about this book. You may ask yourself, well, who is this book really for? The answer is anyone who's interested in Debian, from a regular user to the administrator of a small network or that of a large corporation. And again, it walks you right through from the beginning. You need no prior Debian knowledge. How long is this book? The French paperback was about 450 pages. So that, wow. I don't know if that'll give you any idea of how long the English version will be, but the French paperback was 450 pages. And what version of Debian does it cover? The current book covers the current stable version of Squeeze. Now, this book came out in French quite some time ago. It came out back in Sarge, and they've updated it every time. So it updates and covers the current release. So what I believe will happen is if we can get enough money to make it an apt-get install away, just a totally open source book, that the next time that Debian updates from Squeeze to, I don't know, what's the next one going to be called?
Whatever Toy Story.
Anyway, when they update to the next stable distribution, the book will be updated also. So come on, people, let's get out there and get your copy today and move that project much closer to their goal of open sourcing this book.
Well, Matt, I tell you, I'm a big supporter of donating to projects, so thanks for making me aware of it, and I'll definitely contribute.
Yeah, and if you can contribute anything you want, but if you contribute 10 euros or more, then you're guaranteed a copy of the book. So that's why I went with the 10 euro donations.
So. Sweet.
That sounds reasonable.
All right. And my next story, 2011, the year of the tech giant passing. 2011 has been a year in which we lost more tech giants than ever before, for a total of 14. We'll start the list with arguably the best known on this list and end with the one that I believe had the biggest impact. Our first tech giant that we lost this year was Stephen Paul Jobs, February 1995 to October 2011. Jobs experimented with different pursuits before starting Apple Computers with Stefan Wozniak in the Jobs family garage. Steve Jobs' vision in the consumer electronic market is unparalleled, hence Apple's many revolutionary products, such as the iPod, the iPhone, and the iPad, which are now seen as dictating the evolution of modern technology. And that's one thing that Steve Jobs and Apple did have. Even though I really didn't like his policies, I don't know him as a person, and I don't like Apple for these same reasons, is when you think of closed source, a lot of people think, oh, Microsoft. Well, I'll tell you what, Apple and Steve Jobs makes Microsoft's Bill Gates look like Richard Stallman. Yeah. Okay, because Apple has their stuff so locked down, and they pursue it to keep it locked down so hard. And they and Steve Jobs himself actually was an anti-open source. He was actively anti-open source, and to the point of that, the only open source package left in Apple up until recently was Samba, because they needed it to communicate in the Windows world. And they've been working for years to rewrite SIFS in Apple, in the Apple OS, so that they could rip Samba out, which they completed this year, and they ripped Samba out this year. Jeez. Because Steve Jobs was the very first GPL enforcement action. Did you know that?
No.
Yes, he was the very first person. It was when he was running Next. He had a GPL piece of software in there that he was not abiding by the license for. So, and they just, whenever the GPL people find this stuff out, I think it's Free Software Foundation that administers that. But whenever they find that out, they always send like a cease and desist or a please comply letter. And if you don't, then they take the legal action. Well, he didn't comply, and then they took the legal action.
It's been a vendetta ever since.
Yeah. So, but you got to give him due where his and his vision for consumer electronics was just unparalleled. The devices he created are just became the standard. So, Moving on, the next one is going to be Robert Morris. He's the Unix encryption guy, July 1932 to June 2011. Among the Bell Labs researchers who worked on Unix with Thompson and Ritchie was Bob Morris, who developed Unix's password system, math library, text processing applications, and crypt function. In 1986, Morris left to join the NSA, where he led the agency's National Computer Security Center until 1994. A little bit of a step there from Bell Labs to the NSA. And our next is going to be John McCarthy, the originator of AI. He's also the creator of the Lisp programming language and the father of artificial intelligence. He coined the term in 1956. In 1957, McCarthy started the first work on time sharing on a computer. The original project led to Multics, which then led to Unix. In the early 70s, he predicted online shopping. This prediction led researcher Whitfield Diffie to create public key cryptography used in the authentication of e-commerce documents.
Wow, 1970s.
Yeah, and to inspire Diffie to actually write the encryption that he wrote, I mean, that's...
Yeah.
You can't get... Because a lot of these people we're going to mention are real behind-the-scenes guys. Like, I'd never heard of him until I started researching this. And so... And our next is going to be Ken Olson.
Ken Olson, yep.
Do you know... I didn't know about Ken Olson until I did this. The digital man. When he worked at MIT's Lincoln Laboratory in the 50s, he took note of students queuing up to use an older model computer called a TX-0, even when a more modern and much faster mainframe was available. The big difference, and the reason that the students lined up for the TX-0, was that the mainframe ran batch jobs, and the TX-0 allowed for online interactivity. And by online in the 50s, I'm assuming they meant with the computer itself. So in 1957, he and a colleague, Harlan Anderson, ran with that information and $70,000 in startup capital to start DEC, the Digital Equipment Corporation. DEC went on to create the PDP series of computers, of which Ritchie and Thompson created Unix on a PDP-7.
Mm-hmm. And the DEC backs too. That was a...
DEC made a ton of them. I needed to keep these fairly short, so I only mentioned the PDP series. But yeah, DEC has, up until their demise, I think in the mid '80s, when I think Compaq bought them in the mid '80s, it was IBM and DEC, and that was it. If you had computers, you had an IBM or you had a DEC.
Oh yeah.
So then we have Paul Barron, the Packet Man. Barron, while working as a researcher for the RAND Corporation in 1961, came up with the idea that messages can be broken down into smaller pieces, then sent to a destination, even via multiple routes if necessary, and then put back together when they arrive to ensure delivery. ARPANET adopted packet switching as its means of communication. ARPANET then grew to the internet and eventually for local area networks in the form of Ethernet. So basically it goes back to Paul Barron. I always like to talk about my favorite guy when it comes down to this level has always been Vinton Cerf. Vinton Cerf was one of the two guys that originated the TCP/IP protocol. Okay, without the TCP/IP protocol, we wouldn't be doing anything.
Right.
And I found out when researching this, without Paul Barron, we wouldn't have TCP/IP because he started it all with packet switching. Yeah. So, these guys, and we lost all these people this week. And now Jean Bartek, last of the first programmers, she's also the only woman on the list. She was the last surviving member of the original programming team for ENIAC. If you guys remember ENIAC, it's the big giant computer that takes up like a city block. But that understates her work. She was the only female math graduate in her 1945 college, and she served as a lead programmer on the ENIAC project. Bartek also developed circuit logic and did design work under the direction of ENIAC's hardware developer, J. Presper Eckert. So, I didn't include this here, but she retired at the age of 26 to become a homemaker. She did all of that before 26.
Wow.
Holy cow.
So, yeah. Brilliant. And then we have Jack Keel Wolf, the disk driving man. Wolf did more than almost anyone else to use math to cram more data into magnetic drives, flash memory, and electronic communications channels. In 1984, he moved to the new Center for Magnetic Recording Research at the University of California, San Diego. It was a good choice. Wolf and his students, dubbed the Wolfpack, cross-pollinated magnetic drive design with information theory, applying compression in increasingly creative ways and spreading Wolf's ideas throughout the industry. Basically, he was one of the guys that originated hard drives. Without his compression algorithms, hard drives would still be the size of the table we are broadcasting from. Okay? So, and we've seen how his work's been taken and just jammed down smaller. Then next we have Julius Blank, creator of the silicon in Silicon Valley, June 1925 to September of 2011. Julius Blank, one of the traitorous eight engineers who founded Fairchild Semiconductor in 1957. He and his seven colleagues had acquired that unsavory nickname when they left Nobel Prize-winning physicist William Shockley just a year after being recruited to create a new kind of transistor at Shockley Labs. Before going to college, he had been trained as a machinist, along with the eventual venture capitalist Gene Kleiner. Blank built Fairchild's machine shop and created the manufacturing machinery that would produce the first silicon-based transistors. So, yeah, him and the company that was founded by these guys, Fairfield Semiconductor, they started the use of silicon in transistors, which then became chips. And the machinery he built worked so well and was so durable that he did this in 1957, right? Mm-hmm. In the 1980s, they opened a plant overseas, and they took all the original equipment from the original plant, shipped it overseas, sandblasted it, repainted it, reassembled it, and it's making chips.
Wow.
Impressive.
It is. Yeah. So, yeah. And then we have Robert Galvin, breaker of the AT&T mobile monopoly. Galvin broke AT&T's monopoly on mobile phone service in the U.S. when he demonstrated a Motorola phone for President Reagan at the White House in 1981. Ronald Reagan then pushed the FCC to approve Motorola's proposal for a competing cellular network. By the time Galvin retired as Motorola's chairman in 1990, the company dominated the cell phone hardware business. Mm. Yep, because up until that point, AT&T had, if you needed a mobile phone prior to this in 1981, it was AT&T and that was it. You had no other choice in the U.S.
And Motorola, you know, they rose to prominence. Then they kind of hit a decline a bit, and now, you know, with the Droid series.
Well, because Google bought them. So,
there you go.
Anytime you get an influx of cash like that, and next we have Gerald Lawson, creator of the video game cartridge and also our only African American on this list. Born December 1940 to April 2011, Jerry Lawson, a 6'6", more than 250-pound African American, which was even more of an IT industry rarity in the 70s than today. Lawson's creation, the Fairchild Channel F, arrived in 1976, a year before Atari's first home game system, and sparked an industry of third-party video games. Larson discovered the biggest challenge with plug-in cartridges was satisfying the FCC's radio frequency interference requirements. In a 2006 interview, he describes the process. We had to put the whole motherboard in aluminum. We had a metal chute that went over the cartridge adapter to keep radiation in. Each time we made a cartridge, the FCC wanted to see it, and it had to be tested. Its biggest impact was on Lawson's friends at Atari, who rushed their own cartridge-based home system into production, and the rise of the video game had begun. So, and then next we have George Devil, the man with the robot arm, February 1912 to August of 2011. George Devil developed the first digitally programmable robot arm. He also invented a system for recording sound for movies in the 1930s, then switched to systems that used photoelectric cells to open and close doors and sort barcoded packages. Devil turned his inventiveness to factory automation in the 1950s. The large, programmable Unimate arm he developed used magnetic drum memory and discrete solid-state control components. It made its factory debut in 1961 on a General Motors assembly line in New Jersey, stacking freshly die-cast and very hot metal parts. Within 20 years, Devil's Unimation was the biggest robotic arm company in the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, have you ever seen any videos of the car plants with those welders, those single, those are his. That's, okay. That's that machine.
Ones that move around quickly.
Yeah, and weld those unibody cars. Mm-hmm. Ding, 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 ding. That's his arm. Mm-hmm. And how you program it is super cool. There's a video out there on YouTube, which I came across when I was doing this research, mm-hmm. of not him, but like his lead guy at his company demonstrating this arm on Johnny Carson. He made a golf ball and sinks it. The arm also opens up a beer and pours it, and then the arm conducts the band. And the guy shows how you program it. It's just there's no programming. And my 17-year-old daughter could program this arm. You hook up a controller to it. You plug it into the side, and it follows the movements that you make the controller move, and that's how you program it. You say, like, hit something that says remember, and then you move the arm the way you need it to move via this controller. Mm-hmm. And then when you run it, it moves to the exact pattern that you moved it in.
Hmm. Oh, that's cool.
It is. Like... So, you know, it's super easy. It was an incredible innovation. And if you get a chance, look that video up. It's just, if you Google Unimate or Unimation and Johnny Carson, I'm sure you'll find it. It was pretty nifty. And then Lee Davenport, Any Aircraft Innovator, December 1915 to September 2011. Lee Davenport didn't invent battlefield radar. He developed an anti-aircraft gun that combined radar with a computer to control anti-aircraft guns. At the Battle of the Bulge, the radar system was also used to spot German ground vehicles in the snowy terrain. In addition, the SCR 584 was used in 1944 to defend London against German buzz bombs. The SCR 584 crews were very effective in shooting down the buzz bombs. Something else I found out when I was researching him, too, was those crews weren't initially very effective at shooting down the buzz bombs, because he was in England at the time trying to help him get these mm-hmm. things up and running.
Oh.
And he said he was in his wandering arounds, and when the buzz bombs would start coming in, he would see crews reading the manual to try and figure out how to use it to shoot down these incoming buzz bombs. So, yeah, there was a lack of training. But once they got all the crews up and trained, the buzz bomb hits on London practically ceased. They just effectively took out the buzz bombs.
Sweet.
Then we have Wilson Great Batch, the heartbeat of the century, September 1919 to September of 2011. In 1956, Wilson Great Batch, an electrical engineering professor at the University of Buffalo, made an electronic mistake that led to the invention of the pacemaker. He was building a heart rhythm monitor for the school's chronic disease research facility when he attached a wrong-sized resistor to a circuit, causing it to produce intermittent electrical pulses. Great Batch realized that this might be used to regulate a damaged heart. 2 years later, doctors at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Buffalo demonstrated that a 2-cubic-inch implantable device built by Great Batch could regulate a dog's heartbeat. In 1960 in Buffalo, 10 patients, including 2 children, received Great Batch's device, and its battery lasted 2 years or more. In 1972, Great Batch was able to re-engineer the device with a new battery that worked for more than a decade. Now, he wasn't the only guy to come up with this, however. You know how sometimes great inventions, like if you go back to the...
Independent.
Yeah, like
yeah.
radio.
Yeah.
Marconi wasn't the only guy, but he was the first guy that got it out there.
Right.
So, but in this, Great Batch wasn't the only guy. There was also a guy in, I think it was either England or Germany, that did it at the same time. Because in 1960, he had actually implanted his device in some patients before Great Batch. But his only lasted like 2 months. And Great Batch's had his down to where it lasted longer than 2 years. So that's why his took off, because it was just technically better.
Ah.
But yeah, it was. He wasn't. There was another guy that did it simultaneously, but Great Batch is the guy that did it. And now our last person is Dennis Ritchie. He's the originator of Unix, and he invented the C programming language. September 1941 to October 2011. Dennis Ritchie is one of the authors of the Unix operating system and designed the C programming language. And he promoted both starting in the 70s. You may ask how influential all of that work was. Well, just look at the number of closed source Unix clones we have today, not to mention their open source brethren, the BSDs, along with Linux, which is a Unix workalike. Not to mention C, of which 8 of the top 10 programming languages today are descended from. So, I don't know. I think that if we hadn't had Dennis Ritchie, the computing we know today just wouldn't exist. It just wouldn't exist in the way we know it.
And so that's the person that you mentioned earlier had the most impact.
Yes.
Gotcha.
So.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Matt. That was quite a list. Sad to see all those people no longer with us.
I just, you know, it was just something I thought about researching.
Certainly, so. We certainly appreciate their contributions.
Oh yeah, it's I
tremendously.
Can't, yeah, and you know what I think the cause of just having so many of them pass from us this year too probably is that all this innovation really started at about the same time. Mm-hmm. So they're all of a certain age, and that age is old.
Most of them were in like the mid 20s.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. That's when
one
they
of them
were
was
born.
99. The
1911
devil, yeah. Or was it 11?
12, I think.
12.
Okay, 19.
Yeah,
okay.
He was 99 years old. It's amazing.
So.
Oh yep, that's all I have for the news.
All right, I've got a couple articles, but Mary, do you have something you want to talk about first, or?
No, I think I've pretty much covered what I wanted to cover.
All right. So I've got a couple here. One is the Raspberry Pi. That's that tiny little powerful computer.
Yeah, we talked about that, I don't know, a month or so ago.
Yeah. They're going to come out with an updated version. It has 128 megs of RAM, and the version without the network is going to be $25.
Is without networking
computer.
At all?
Yeah.
Yeah, because if you could look back, I talked about this about 2 or 3 months ago.
Yeah, but it's supposed to be released this upcoming month. They're supposed to.
Yeah, because that was all pre-release stuff. They weren't. Yeah.
And then $35 for the version with Ethernet. So something like this, you could literally get your toaster running on Linux.
Yeah, and you could have a whole computer in your pocket. You can walk around. It's like this big.
Yeah, it's the size of a flash drive, just slightly larger.
I do seem to recall something along. Now, I have played around with the Tonito server, but that's the power source for that Raspberry Pi server / system. Is it completely self-contained, or do you have to plug it into something?
No, it's going to be, you have to have it plugged in.
So even though it's in your pocket, you're going to have a cord to the outlet.
Right.
Yes.
All right. That's.
But was the Raspberry the one that runs on USB? Like you plug it in. And
I think.
It, right
I think. Yeah. I think if you plug it into USB, it'll run. It powers itself from the USB.
That's
power.
Cool. This one's showing has they're running HDMI ports, and they have 1080p video running, so you can have it built into a TV, and have full computer usage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Well, thanks for mentioning that. Check that out.
Yeah, check
it
out.
Oh, yeah, check it out. It's running. They're playing Doom on it. On the one I'm looking at.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. At least that looks like a Doom maze, if I remember my Doom mazes correctly. But it looks like they're playing Doom.
Did you say, Tony, did you share the price at this?
The Ethernet version is $35.
Okay.
At least that's their price.
Right, and the non-Ethernet's $25.
Yeah. Oh, wait, here it says it's powered by a 5-volt power supply. So that could be
a
USB port or
okay.
A battery. Yeah.
Okay.
Because USB runs on 5 volts.
Okay.
Right. We also have, I found, the year in review for Linux desktop development 2011. That's on thevarguy.com. Have you guys ever been to that website?
Thevarguy.com.
I ran across it when I was in the Yahoo News, and it looks pretty interesting. This article is by Christopher Tozzi, T-O-Z-Z-I. Maybe it's Tozzi. I don't know how to say his name.
I just went to varguy.com, and I got, please come back later.
Is it the Varguy?
Oh, it is. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, I got the same thing.
Here we go. Now it looks like it's going somewhere.
Yeah. So he talks about how Ubuntu switched to Unity. Made a lot of changes, just their, from in the 11.4 and then 11.10, they made updates, but.
It's still hated by everybody?
No. It's amazing.
No
that
comment.
It's
Unity
it's
sucks.
It's definitely mixed bag.
Have you used it, Mary? Have you used Unity at all?
No, I haven't. I mean, I've seen the desktop. I've seen demos of it, but.
I use it because I have Ubuntu Netbook Remix on a netbook, mm-hmm. on a little netbook, and I use it there, and it works well there. But for the little bit of that I use that netbook, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine it being my daily productive working environment.
Well, I think what I like about it is the fact that all those icons over on the left side,
yeah.
because I'm left-handed, it's very convenient to have them over on that side of the screen. But, again, I haven't really used it, so...
I don't know. You get me away from my traditional bar at the bottom and my desktop with my windows that I can move around. I'm pretty much hating it.
Well, you know, I'm using it, and...
I know you're using it.
I don't think
it.
It's that bad. I'm not sold on it. You know, I want to give it a couple releases to try. Although I do want to try out GNOME 3.
If you try GNOME 3, I would give the MGSE extensions a chance first and then turn them off because you can turn them off one at a time. And
I don't know. I think I would go in the opposite direction.
Really?
Yeah, try what they suggest. See how bad it actually is. Because I've heard a lot of people talk about it and how they like it. So
well, Klaatu said how he liked it and then took it all back.
It's better than the, a lot of people say it's better than Unity. But my thing is, I use like 5 programs. I use the terminal, and I use Chrome and Evolution. And past that, maybe 2 other programs. So why not just have I had the launchers at the top on GNOME 2.6 or 2.8, whatever, you know, the last version. So it's basically the same thing.
You know what? Now
sidebar.
That you're saying it, because I use more than that. On a regular basis, I'm using Chrome, I'm using the terminal, I'm using GPotter, and I'm using LibreOffice, Calc, and Writer,
yeah.
and Presenter. I'm using those, what was that, 4 or 5 apps? So, but I don't know. I just don't like it.
Well, the other thing is that you hit the logo and it pops up that lens thing. That's pretty confusing to me. But it's an easy search. You just type in, you want to change the monitor screen, you just type in monitor and it pops up right there. You know, I mean, if you're not averse to using the keyboard, then
no,
it's
I'm
actually
not
pretty
averse
convenient.
To using the keyboard at all.
Then perhaps you could get to like.
No. I have found mate and I'm in love.
Yeah. He also talks about how the GNOME 3 updates coming out, and then in the summer we had the Linux 3.0 kernel, the Ubuntu Software Center. You know, they came out with that a couple years ago, but now they're having pay versions of programs in there, so you can link your PayPal account and buy software through it. So it's very similar to Marketplace or the App Store and things like that. LibreOffice had their first official release was in January, so coming up will be their 1 year mark for their first release. And then the Ubuntu pre-installations. He says even though that's not something new this year, but Asus has came out with a set of their netbooks that are running Ubuntu.
Again?
Yeah.
Because remember when Windows paid all that money, when netbooks first hit the market, and at that, I forget, that big China tech show, and they were all shown there, and they all were running Linux, and then Microsoft behind the scenes went to all of the manufacturers and basically gave them, not really money, but they said, we'll sell you Windows to run on there at such a discounted rate that they just all went with it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it kind of crushed Linux in the netbook at that point.
Well, it says on here, it's only being... released in China and Portugal, so it's not like we're going to see it.
Unless Gibby with his famous Chinese purchases of that stuff might come up with a netbook running it.
Right. So it's pretty interesting. And that was my 2 articles I could look up while I was waiting for the ball to drop last night.
Yep. So yeah, that was some pretty interesting stuff, Tony. I especially like that Pi, that Raspberry Pi. I'm probably going to get the $35 version of that. Just check it out.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
I think I will too.
I didn't see any pictures, so I don't know if it's going to be.
Oh, I saw. I saw like 3 different pictures of it.
Oh yeah.
Oh, but they were all of the beta version. So there was no box ever. There was no case on it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm curious to see what kind of case it's going to be in.
It'd be really cool to run that as your like home theater PC or something.
Well, yeah.
It'd be tiny. All you do is like you can Velcro it right to your TV.
How much onboard storage does it have?
No onboard storage.
So except
it's got enough to run the OS.
Right.
So it's got some flash storage, I'm sure.
Yeah. So maybe 512 somewhere.
That's got probably more than that. There. Probably 2 gigs.
Okay.
Because even the really lightweight stuff nowadays, you need.
Yeah, here it doesn't show the flash that's on it, but it says for RAM, it has 128 megs of RAM. So it's really light.
Yeah.
Light work stuff.
Yeah, you're not going to be using this as a desktop replacement.
Right.
So. Well, have either of you heard of the Shiva plug computer?
The Shiva plug. Yes, I have.
I've heard of it, but I've...
You were using it for a while, weren't you, Mary?
Not... Well, I think I was using a branded version, Tornado.
Okay, yeah.
And it worked pretty well, but eventually... I was maintaining it in a room that was too hot for it, I think, and I think I burnt it out prematurely.
Ooh.
But I broke it, so I haven't replaced it yet. But when it was working, I liked it. I just plugged in a at the time it was 500 gigabytes was the hard size, a typical hard drive size. So I plugged one of those in, had all my music and all that, so I could stream it.
Yeah, and the nifty thing about it was it had that web interface on it, right, where you could do
exactly.
It, right, even if you weren't inside your house, you could do it across the internet wherever you were. So, yeah.
That's
yeah.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I used a non-standard port just to try to hide it. But
that old security by obscurity trick.
Yeah.
We all know how well that works, huh?
Yeah. So that's what I did.
So, well, that's pretty cool.
Cool. Yeah. I didn't notice any real listener feedback come through, although we get a ton of spam. So if you make a comment on the website and it gets deleted, then email us. That's show@smlr.us. Or go onto our website and use the contact form. Let me know, you know, so I can look for it or something otherwise. Because I'm using AskMit. And that it goes through and it searches.
It pretty aggressively hunts for spam on our boards. So if it thinks you're spam at all, it's going to dump you out. So if that happens to you and you've made a comment, just let us know. We'll get it fixed up for you.
Yeah.
Or what about putting maybe a certain keyword in the title of the comment? Can you program that your spam?
Yeah, put in that this is a real person, not spam. No, I don't know.
Might be something to try.
Yeah,
I'm not familiar with that particular spam filtering program. So
it's whatever comes with WordPress.
Okay.
I mean, it actually works pretty good because there's a ton of spam. I generally read most of it, but if you type something that says, this article and don't say anything about what the actual article is, it's spam. So I delete it. So you gotta like put some actual thought into it, or make it so it doesn't look like spam.
Yeah, because those spammers, that's what they do. They go, man, what a great show. Now check out Woogie Boogie. Buy this now.
Right.
And actually, put a big link in there.
A lot of them don't put the link in there, but their link is their...
signature file.
Yeah, their signature.
And I'll tell you, a couple days ago, I can't recall what I was searching for, but I came across a couple of spam blogs. I mean, it was clearly apparent.
That happened to me yesterday.
I hadn't seen those before.
And it was the second link down in my Google search. How does that happen? It had no information about what I was searching for at all, and just tons of spam on the page.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How does that become the second?
Really,
how does that become the second link in my freaking Google search?
Good
really
SEO?
Good SEO. Yeah. Search engine optimization. There's actually a lady that was. I can't remember the full story, but they were talking about NPR, that she was convicted of slander because she had some beef with a company and then made up like 10,000 websites that all said how this company was bad and new SEO. So she was hitting the first like 10 hits was her websites before that actual company's website came up. So she got convicted, and but what she tried to do is go to the company and says, no, I know, and saying, you know, she was trying to say that she's not the person doing it. I see all this bad stuff, and for $10,000, I can get rid of it for you. Thinking, you know, her as a service.
So she really tried to blackmail the company. That's what she got convicted of.
Yeah, you know, I think it was. It was Blackmore.
Right.
Yeah.
And now is she in prison?
I think she just had, you know. I honestly can't remember the whole story. It's been about a month since I heard it.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah, it's something strange like that. All right,
that's all I have.
Yeah, I think that's about it.
Yep, same here.
Thanks for joining us, Mary. And
well,
hopefully
thanks for
this will become
me.
Normal.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it.
I'll tell you, I enjoyed myself.
All right.
Excellent.
You've been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. This has been episode 12 for the week of January 1st, 2012.
Mary says she may make up our intro music.
On her theremin. we're working on her because we've been looking for that intro music since we started, and Mary does have a theremin.
Featured music of the week.
Yeah, but for our outro music, I found a song. Now, this was hard for me to look because I was trying to find something that was New Year's, but there was nothing I could really that I liked that I could find. So I just found this artist. It's called the artist is Of The Eye, and it has a picture of like a artistic eye look. It's interesting, but it's called Stopping the World. So have a listen. Thank you.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Share Alike, 3.0 license.